Well, you'd better make up your mind. You haven't got all day. And nix on that we stuff. It's you that's got to do it. You're the boss, not me, the underling countered callously. For once, he was really glad that he was not the one in command. And you'd better get busy and do it, too. I'll do it, the chief declared grimly. There's a way. There was a way. One only. He must be brought in alive, and compelled to divulge the truth. There was no other way. The Bosconian touched a stud and spoke.
Don't kill him. Bring him in alive. If you kill him, even accidentally, I'll kill both of you myself.
The gray lensman made his carefree way down the alley-like thoroughfare, whistling inharmoniously and very evidently at peace with the universe. It takes something, friends, to walk knowingly into a trap, without betraying emotion or stress, even while a blackjack wielded by a strong arm is descending toward the back of your head. Something of quality, something of fiber, something of je ne sais quoi. But whatever it took, Kinnison in ample measure had. He did not wink, flinch, or turn an eye as the billy club came down. Only as it touched his hair did he act, exerting all his marvelous muscular control to jerk forward and downward with the weapon and head of it, to spare himself as much as possible of the terrific blow. The blackjack crunched against the base of the lensman's skull in a shower of coruscating constellations. He fell. He lay there, twitching feebly. Chapter 8. Cat Eagles. As has been said, Kinnison rode the blow of the blackjack forward and downward, thus robbing it of some of its power. It struck him hard enough, so that the thug did not suspect the truth. He thought that he had all but taken the lensman's life. And for all the speed with which the Tellurian had yielded before the blow, he was hurt, but he was not stunned. Therefore, although he made no resistance when the two bullies rolled him over, lashed his feet together, tied his hands behind him, and lifted him into a car, he was fully conscious throughout the proceedings. When the cab was perhaps half an hour upon its way, the lensman struggled back, quite realistically, to consciousness.
"Take it easy, pal," the larger of his thought-screened captors advised, dangling the blackjack suggestively before his eyes. "One yelp out of you, or a signal if you've got one of them lenses, and I'd bop you another one."
"What the blinding blue hell's coming off here?" demanded the Doc Walloper furiously. "What do you think you're doing, you lop-eared—"
and he cursed the two viciously and comprehensively.
"Shut up, or he'll knock you kicking,"
the smaller thug advised from the driver's seat, and Kinnison subsided.
"Not that it bothers me any, but you're making too damn much noise."
"But what's the matter?"
Kinnison asked, more quietly.
"What did you slug me for and drag me off?
I ain't done nothing. I ain't got nothing."
"I don't know nothing," the big agent replied. "The boss will tell you all you need to know when we get to where we're going. All I know is the boss says to bop you easy-like and bring you in alive if you don't act up. He says to tell you not to yell and not to use no lens. If you yell, we burn you out. If you use any lens, the boss, he's got his eyes on all the bases and spaceports and everything, and if any help starts to come this way, he'll tell us, and we fry you and buzz off. We can kill you and flit before any help gets near you, he says."
"Your boss ain't got the brains of a Fantima," Kinnison growled. He knew that the boss, wherever he was, could hear every word. "Hell's hinges, if I was a lensman, you think I'd be walloping junk on a dock? Use your head, Cully, if you got one."
"I wouldn't know nothing about that," the other replied stolidly.
"But I ain't got no lens," the Doc Walloper stormed in exasperation. "Look at me, frisk me, you'll see that I ain't."
"All that ain't none of my dish," the thug was entirely unmoved. "I don't know nothing, I don't do nothing, except what the boss tells me, you see. Now take it easy, all nice and quiet-like. If you don't," and he flicked the blackjack lightly against the lensman's knee, "I'll put out your landing lights. I'll lay you like a mat, and I don't mean maybe, see?" Kinnison saw, and relapsed into silence. The automobile rolled along, and, flitting industriously about upon its delivery duties,
but never much more or less than one measured mile distant. A panel job pursued its devious way. Oddly enough, its chauffeur was a lensman. Here and there, high in the heavens, were a few airplanes, gyros, and copters. But they were going peacefully and steadily about their business, even though most of them happened to have lensmen as pilots. And, not at the base at all, but high in the stratosphere and so thoroughly screened that a spy-ray observer could not even tell that his gaze was being blocked, a battlecruiser, lensman commanded, rode poised upon flare-baffled, softly hissing underjets, and, equally high and as adequately protected against observation, a keen-eyed lensman sat at the controls of a speedster, jazzing her muffled jets and peering eagerly through a telescopic sight. As far as the patrol was concerned, everything was on the trips. The car approached the gates of a suburban estate and stopped. It waited. Kinnison knew that the Bosconian within was working his every beam, alert for any sign of patrol activity. Knew that if there was any such sign, the car would be off in an instant. But there was no activity. Kinnison sent a thought to Gerond, who relayed micrometric readings of the objective to various lensmen. Still, everyone waited. Then the gate opened of itself. The two thugs jerked their captive out of the car to the ground, and Kinnison sent out his signal. Base remained quiet, but everything else erupted at once. The airplanes wheeled, cruiser and speedster plummeted downward at maximum blast. The panel job literally fell open, as did the cage within it, and four ravening cat-eagles, with the silent ferocity of their kind, rocketed toward their goal. Although the Oglons were not as fast as the flying ships, they did not have nearly as far to go, wherefore they got there first. The thugs had no warning whatever. One instant everything was under control. In the next, the noiselessly arrowing destroyers struck their prey with the mad fury that only a striking cat-eagle can exhibit. Barbed talons dug viciously into eyes, faces, mouths, tearing, rending, wrenching. Fierce driven fangs tore deeply, savagely into defenseless throats. Once each, the thugs screamed in mad, lethal terror. But no warning was given. For by that time, every building upon that pretentious estate had disappeared in the pyrotechnic flare of detonating duodec. The pellets were small, of course. The gunners did not wish either to destroy the nearby residences or to injure Kinnison. But they were powerful enough for the purpose intended. Mansion and outbuildings disappeared, and not even the most thoroughgoing spy-ray search revealed the presence of anything animate or structural where those buildings had been. The panel job drove up, and Kinnison, perceiving that the cat-eagles had done their work, sent them back into their cage. The lensman driver, after securely locking cage and truck, cut the Earthman's bonds. "QX, Kinnison?" he asked. "QX, Barnett, thanks." And the two lensmen, one in the panel truck and the other in the gangster's car, drove back to headquarters. There Kinnison recovered his package. "This has got me all of a soapy dither, but you have called the turn on every play yet," Winstead told the Tellurian later. "Is this all of the big shots, do you think, or are there some more of them around here?" "Not around here, I'm pretty sure," Kinnison replied. "No, two main lines is all they would have had, I think, this time."
"Next time?"
"There won't be any next time," Winstead declared. "Not on this planet, no. Knowing what to expect, you fellows can handle anything that comes up. I was thinking then of my next step."
"Oh,
but you'll get 'em, Grey Lensman."
"I hope so," he said, soberly.
"Lock, Kinnison. Clear ether, Winstead," and this time the Tellurian really did flit. As his speedster ripped through the void, Kinnison did more thinking. But he was afraid that Mentor would have considered the product muddy indeed. He couldn't seem to get to the first check station. One thing was limpidly clear. This line of attack, or any very close variation of it, would never work again. He'd have to think up something new. So far, he had got away with his stuff because he had kept one lap ahead of them. But how much longer could he manage to keep up the pace? Bollinger was no mental giant, of course. But this other lad was nobody's fool, and this next higher-up, with whom he had had the interview via Bominger, would certainly prove to be a really shrewd number. "The higher, the fewer," he repeated to himself, the old saying, adding, "and in this case, the smarter." He had to put out some jets, but where he was going to get the fuel he simply didn't know. Again, the trip to Tellus was uneventful, and the gray lensman, the symbol of his rank again flashing upon his wrist, sought interview with Haines.
"Send him in, certainly, send him in," Kinnison heard the communicator crackle,
and the receptionist passed him along. He paused in surprise, however, at the doorway of the office, for Surgeon Marshal Lacey and a Posenian were in conference with the Port Admiral.
"Come in, Kinnison," Haines invited. "Lacey wants to see you a minute, too. Dr. Phillips, Lensman Kinnison, unattached." "His name isn't Phillips, of course. We gave him that in self-defense to keep from trying to pronounce his real one."
Phillips, the Pelsinian, was as tall as Kinnison and heavier. His figure was somewhat human in shape, but not in detail. He had four arms instead of two, each arm had two opposed hands, and each hand had two thumbs, one situated about where a little finger would be expected. He had no eyes, not even vestigial ones. He had two broad, flat noses and two toothful mouths, one of each in what would ordinarily be called the front of his round, shining, hairless head, the other in the back. Upon the sides of his head were large, volute, highly dirigible ears, and, like most races having the faculty of perception instead of that of sight, his head was relatively immobile, his neck being short, massive, and tremendously strong.
"You look well, very well," Lacey reported, after prodding and feeling vigorously the members which had been in his splints and casts so long. "Have to take a picture, of course, but before saying anything definite. No, we won't either now. Phillips, look at his—"
an interlude of technical jargon,
"and see what kind of recovery he has made."
Then, while the Pacinian was examining Kinnison's interior mechanisms, the Surgeon Marshal went on.
"Wonderful diagnosticians and surgeons, these Pacinians, can see into the patient without taking him apart. In another few centuries, every doctor will have to have the sense of perception. Phillips is doing a research in neurology, more particularly a study of the neural synapse and the proliferation of neural dendrites."
"Lacey," Haines drawled the word in reproof. "I've told you a thousand times to talk English when you're talking to me. How about it, Kinnison?"
"Afraid I can't quite check you, Chief," Kinnison grinned. "Specialists, precisionists, can't talk in basic."
"Right, my boy, surprisingly and pleasingly right," Lacey exclaimed. "Why can't you adopt that attitude, Haines, and learn enough words so you can understand what a man's talking about? But to reduce it to monosyllabic simplicity, Phillips is studying a thing that has baffled us for thousands of years. The lower forms of cells are able to regenerate themselves. Wounds heal, bones knit. Higher types, such as nerve cells, regenerate imperfectly, if at all. And the highest type, the brain cells, do not do so under any conditions." He turned a reproachful gaze upon Haines. "This is terrible. Those statements are pitiful, inadequate, false. Worse than that, practically meaningless. What I wanted to say, and what I'm going to say, is that—"
"Oh, no, you aren't. Not in this office," his old friend interrupted. "We got the idea perfectly. The question is, why can't human beings repair nerves or spinal cords or grow new ones? If such a worthless beastie as a starfish can grow a whole new body to one leg, including a brain, if any, why can't a really intelligent victim of simple infantile paralysis, or a ray, recover the use of a leg that is otherwise in perfect shape?"
"Well, that is something like it, but I hope you can aim closer than that at a battleship," Lacey grunted. "We'll buzz off now, Phillips, and leave those two warhorses alone."
"Here's my report in detail."
Kinnison placed the package upon the Port Admiral's desk as soon as the room was sealed behind the visitors. "I talked to you direct about most of it. This is for the record."
"Of course. Mighty glad you found meat on, for our sake as well as theirs. They have things that we need, badly."
"Where did they put them? I suggested a sun near Sol, so as to have them handy to prime base."
"Right next door, Alpha Centauri. Didn't get to do much scouting, did you?"
"I'll say we didn't. Bosconia owns that galaxy, lock, stock, and barrel."
Maybe some other independent planets. Bound to be, of course. Probably a lot of them. But it's too dangerous hunting them at this stage of the game. But at that, we did enough for the time being. We proved our point. Voskone, if there is any such being, is certainly in the second galaxy. However, it will be a long time before we're ready to carry the war there to him, and in the meantime, we've got a lot to do, check? To 19 decimals. It seems to me, then, that while you are rebuilding our first-line ships, superpowering them with Medonian insulation and conductors, I had better keep on tracing Voskone along the line of drugs. I'm just about sure that they're back of the whole drug business.
And in some ways, their drugs are more dangerous to civilization than their battleships. More insidious and ultimately more fatal.
Check. And since I am perhaps as well equipped as any of the other lensmen to cope with that particular problem... Kinnison paused, questioningly.
That certainly is no overstatement, the port admiral agreed, dryly.
You're the only one equipped to cope with it.
None of the other boys except Wurzel, then? I heard that a couple...
They thought they had a call, but they didn't. All they had was a wish. They came back.
Too bad. But I can see how it would be. It's a rough course, and if a man's mind isn't completely ready for it, it burns it out. It almost does, anyway. Mind is a funny thing. But that isn't getting us anywhere. Can you take time to let me talk to you for a few minutes?
I certainly can. You've got the most important assignment in the galaxy. I'd like to know more about it, if it's anything you can pass on.
Nothing that need be sealed from any lensman. The main object of all of us, as you know, is to push Voskonia out of this galaxy. From a military standpoint, they practically are out. Their drug syndicate, however, is very decidedly in, and getting in deeper all the time. Therefore, we next push the Zwilniks out. They have peddlers and such small fry who deal with distributors and so on. These fellows form the bottom layer. Above them are the secret agents, the observers, and the wholesale handlers, runners, and importers. All these folks are directed and controlled by one man, the boss of each planetary organization. Thus, Bominger was the boss of all Zwilnik activities on the whole planet of Radelix. In turn, the planetary bosses report to and are synchronized and controlled by a regional director, who supervises the activities of a couple of hundred or so planetary outfits. I got a line on the one over Bominger, you know. Prelin, the Colonian. By the way, you knew, didn't you, that Helmuth was a Colonian, too?
I got it from the tape. Smart people they must be, but not my idea of good neighbors.
I'll say not. Well, that's all I really know of their organization. It seems logical to suppose, though, that the structure is coherent all the way up. If so... The regional directors would be under some higher-up, possibly a galactic director, who in turn might be under Voskone himself, or one of his cabinet officers, at least. Perhaps the galactic director might even be a cabinet officer in their government, whatever it is.
An ambitious program you've got mapped out for yourself. How are you figuring on swinging it?
That's the rub. I don't know, Kinnison confessed ruefully. But if it's done at all, that's the way I've got to go about it. Any other way would take 1,000 years and more men than we'll ever have. This way works fine when it works at all.
I can see that. Lop off the head and the body dies, Haynes agreed.
That's the way it works, especially when the head keeps detailed records and books covering activities of all the members of his body. With Bominger and the others gone, and with full transcripts of his accounts, the boys mopped up Radelix in a hurry. From now on, it'll be simple to keep it clean, except, of course, for the usual bootleg trickle, and that can be reduced to a minimum. Similarly, if we can put this Prelin away and take a good look at his ledgers, it'll be easy to clear up his 200 planets, and so on.
Very clear and quite simple, in theory.
The older man was thoughtful and frankly dubious.
In practice, difficult in the extreme.
But necessary, the younger insisted.
I suppose so, Haynes assented finally. Useless to tell you to not take chances. You'll have to. But for all our sakes, if not for your own, be as careful as you can.
I'll do that, Chief. I think a lot of me. As much as anybody, maybe more, and careful is my middle name.
Uh-huh, Haynes grunted skeptically. We've noticed that.
Anything special you want done? Yes, very special, Kinnison surprised him by answering in the affirmative. You know that the Madonians developed a scrambler for a detector nullifier. Hotchkiss and the boys developed a new line of attack on that. Against long-range stuff, we're probably safe, but they haven't been able to do a thing on electromagnetics. Well, the Bosconians, beginning with Prellin, are going to start wondering what has been happening. Then, if I succeed in getting Prellin, they're bound to start doing things. One thing they'll do will be to fix up their headquarters so that they'll have about 500% overlaps on their electros. Perhaps they'll have outposts, too, close enough together to have the same thing there, possibly 200 or 300 even on visuals. In that case, you stay out. Not necessarily. What do electros work on? Iron, I suppose, they did when I went to school last. The answer, then, is to build me a speedster that is inherently indetectable, absolutely non-ferrous. Berlinium and so on for all the structural parts. But you've got to have silicon steel cores for your electrical equipment.
I was coming to that.
Have you? I was reading in the transactions the other day that force fields had been used in big units and were more efficient. Some of the smaller units, instruments and so on, might have to have some iron, but wouldn't it be possible to so saturate those small pieces with a dense field of detector frequencies that they wouldn't react? I don't know. Never thought of it, would it?
I don't know either. I'm not telling you, I'm just making suggestions.
I do know one thing, though. We've got to keep ahead of them. Think of things first and oftenest, and be ready to abandon them for something else as soon as we've used them once.
Except for those primary projectors, Haynes grinned wryly. They can't be abandoned. Even with Madonian power, we haven't been able to develop a screen that will stop them. We've got to keep them secret from Boscone, and in that connection I want to compliment you on the suggestion of having Vigilantian lensmen as mind readers whenever their projectors are even being thought of.
You caught spies then? How many?
Not many. 3 or 4 in each base, but enough to have done the damage. Now I believe for the first time in history we can be sure of our entire personnel.
I think so. Mentor says the lens is enough if we use it properly. That's up to us.
But how about visuals? Haynes was still worrying, and to good purpose.
Well, we have a black coating now that's 99% absorptive, and I don't need ports or windows. At that, though, 1% reflection would be enough to get me away at a critical time. How would it be to put a couple of the boys on that job, have them put a decimal point after the 99, and see how many 9s they can tack on behind it?
That's a thought, Kinnison. They'll have lots of time to work on it while the engineers are trying to fill your specifications as to a speedster. But you're right, dead right. We, or rather you, have got to outthink them, and it certainly is up to us to do everything we can to build the apparatus to put your thoughts into practice. And it isn't at some vague time in the future that Boscone is going to start doing something about you and what you've done. It's right now, or even more probably a week or so ago. But you haven't said a word yet about the really big job you have in mind.
I've been putting that off until the last, the Grey Lensman's voice held obscure puzzlement. The fact is, I simply can't get a tooth into it. Can't get a grip on it anywhere. I don't know enough about math or physics. Everything comes out negative for me, not only inertia, but also force, velocity, and even mass itself. Final results always contain an I, too, the square root of -1. I can't get rid of it, and I don't see how it can be built into any kind of apparatus. It may not be workable at all, but before I give up the idea, I'd like to call a conference if it's QX with you in the council.
Certainly it is QX with us. You're forgetting again, aren't you, that you're a Grey Lensman?
Haynes' voice held no reproof. He was positively beaming with a super-fatherly pride.
Not exactly, Kinnison blushed, almost squirmed.
I'm just too much of a cub to be sticking my neck out so far, is all. The idea may be, probably is wilder than a Raelegian cat-eagle. The only kind of a conference that could even begin to handle it would cost a young fortune, and I don't want to spend that much money on my own responsibility. To date, your ideas have worked out well enough so that the council is backing you 100%,
the older man said dryly.
Expense is no object.
Then, his voice changing markedly,
Kim, have you any idea at all of the financial resources of the patrol?
Very little, sir, if any, I'm afraid, Kinnison confessed. Here on Tellus alone, we have an expendable reserve of over 10,000 million credits. With the restriction of government to its proper sphere and its concentration into our organization, resulting in the liberation of manpower into wealth-producing enterprise, and especially with the enormous growth of interworld commerce, world income increased to such a point that taxation could be reduced to a minimum, and the lower the taxes, the more flourishing businesses became, and the greater the income. Now, the tax rate is the lowest in history. The total income tax, for instance, in the highest bracket, is only 3.592%. At that, however, if it had not been for the recent slump due to Bosconian interference with intersystemic commerce, we would have had to reduce the tax rate again to avoid serious financial difficulty due to the fact that too much of the galactic total of circulating credit would have been concentrated in the expendable funds of the Galactic Patrol. So, don't even think of money. Whether you want to spend 1,000 credits, 1,000,000, or 1,000,000,000, go ahead.
Thanks, Chief. Glad you explained. I'll feel better now about spending money that doesn't belong to me. Now, if you'll give me, for about a week, the use of the librarian in charge of science files and a galactic beam, I'll quit bothering you.
I'll do that.
The port admiral touched a button, and in a few minutes a trimly attractive blonde entered the room.
Miss Hostetter, this is Lensman Kinnison, unattached. Please turn over your regular duties to an assistant, and work with him until he releases you. Whatever he says goes. The sky's the limit.
In the Library of Science, Kinnison outlined his problem briefly to his new aide, concluding, I want only about 50, as a larger group could not cooperate efficiently. Are your lists arranged so that you can skim off the top 50?
Such a group can be selected, I think.
The girl stood for a moment, lower lip held lightly between white teeth.
That is not a standard index, but each scientist has a rating. I can set the acceptor... No, the rejector would be better, to throw out all the cards above any given rating. If we take out all ratings over 700, we will have only the highest of the geniuses.
How many do you suppose?
I have only a vague idea. A couple of hundred, perhaps. If too many, we can run them again at a higher level, say 710. But there won't be very many, since there are only 2 galactic ratings higher than 750. There will be duplications, too. Such people as Sir Austin Cardange will have 2 or 3 cards in the final rejects.
QX, we'll want to handpick the 50 anyway. Let's go.
Then, for hours, bale after bale of cards went through the machine. Thousands of records per minute. Occasionally, one card would flip out into a rack, rejected. Finally,
that's all, I think. Mathematicians, physicists.
The librarian ticked off upon pink fingers.
Astronomers, philosophers, and this new classification which hasn't been named yet.
The HTTs.
Kinnison glanced at the label, lightly lettered in pencil, fronting the slim packet of cards.
Aren't you going to run them through too?
No. Those are the 2 I mentioned a minute ago, the only ones higher than 750.
A choice pair, huh? Sort of a creme de la creme.
Let's look them over.
And he extended his hand.
What do the initials stand for?
I'm awfully sorry, sir, really.
The girl flushed in embarrassment as she relinquished the cards in high reluctance.
If I'd had any idea, we wouldn't have dared. We call you, among ourselves, the high-tension thinkers.
Us?
It was the lensman's turn to flush. Nevertheless, he took the packet and read sketchily the facer. Class XIX. Unclassifiable at present. Lack of adequate methods. Minds of range and scope far beyond any available indices. Ratings above high genius, 750. Yet no instability. Power beyond any heretofore known. Assigned ratings tentative and definitely minimum. He then read the cards.
Warsel, Volantia, 800.
And Kimball Kinnison, Tellus, 875.
Chapter 9. Ike and Derisian.
The port admiral was eminently correct in supposing that Boscone, whoever or whatever he or it might be, was already taking action upon what the Tellurian lensman had done. For even as Kinnison was at work in the Library of Science, A meeting which was to indirectly affect him no little was being called to order. In the immediately distant second galaxy was that meeting being held, upon the then planet Jarnavon of the Ike, within that sullen fortress already mentioned briefly. Presiding over it was the indescribable entity known to history as Ikelin, or more properly, Lan of the Ike.
"Baskon is now in session," that entity announced to the eight other similar monstrosities, who in some fashion indescribable to man were stationed at the long, low, wide bench of stone-like material which served as a table of state. 9 days ago, each of us began to search for whatever new facts might bear upon the activities of the as-yet entirely hypothetical lensman who, Helmuth believed, was the real force back of our recent intolerable reverses in the Tellurian galaxy. As first of Boscon, I will report as to the military situation. As you know, our positions there became untenable with the fall of our grand base, and all our mobile forces were withdrawn. In order to facilitate reorganization, coordinating ships were sent out. Some of these ships went to planets held in toto by us. Not one of these vessels has been able to report any pertinent facts whatever. Ships approaching bases of the patrol, or encountering patrol ships of war in space, simply ceased communicating. Even their automatic recorders ceased to function without transmitting any intelligible data, indicating complete destruction of those ships. A cascade system in which one ship followed another at long range and with analytical instruments set to determine the nature of any beam or weapon employed was attempted. The enemy, however, threw out blanketing zones of tremendous power, and we lost 6 more vessels without obtaining the desired data. These are the facts, all negative. Theorizing, deduction, summation, and integration will, as usual, come later. Ike Mill, second of Boscon, will now report.
My facts are also entirely negative, the second began. Soon after our operations upon the planet Radalex became productive of results, a contingent of Tellurian narcotic agents arrived, which may or may not have included the lensman.
Stick to the facts for the time being, Ikelin ordered curtly. Shortly thereafter, a minor agent, a female instructed to wear a thought screen at all times, lost her usefulness by suffering a mental disorder which incapacitated her quite seriously. Then, another agent, also a female, this time one of the Third Order who had been very useful up to that time, ceased reporting. A few days later, Bominger, the planetary director, failed to report, as did the planetary observer, who, as you know, was entirely unknown to and had no connection with the operating staff. Reports from other sources, such as importers and shippers, these, I believe, are here admissible as facts, indicate that all our personnel upon Radalex have been liquidated. No unusual developments have occurred upon any other planet, nor has any significant fact, however small, been discovered. Ikenor, third of Boscon.
Also negative. Our every source of information from within the bases of the patrol has been shut off. Every one of our representatives, some of whom have been reporting regularly for many years, have been silent, and every effort to reach any of them has failed.
Ike Snap, fourth of Boscon.
Utterly negative. We have been able to find no trace whatever of the planet Medon, or of any one of the 21 warships investing it at the time of its disappearance.
And so on, through 9 reports, while the tentacles of the mighty first of Boscon played intermittently over the keys of a complex instrument or machine before him.
"We will now reason, theorize, and draw conclusions," the first announced, and each of the organisms fed his ideas and deductions into a machine.
It whirred briefly, then ejected a tape, which Eichlin took up and scanned narrowly.
"Rejecting all conclusions having a probability of less than 95%, he announced, "we have, first, a set of three probabilities of a value of 99 and 99 one-hundredths virtual certainties that some one Tellurian lensman is the prime mover behind what has happened, that he has acquired a mental power heretofore unknown to his race, and that he has been in large part responsible for the development of the patrol's new and formidable weapons. Second, a probability of 99% that he and his organization are no longer on the defensive but have assumed the offensive. Third, one of 97% that it is not primarily Tellus which is an obstacle, even though the Galactic Patrol and civilization did originate upon that planet, but Aresia, that Helmuth's report was at least partially true. Fourth, one of 95.5% that the lens is also concerned in the disappearance of the planet Medon. There is a lesser probability, but still of some 94%, that that same lensman is involved here. I will interpolate here that the vanishment of that planet is a much more serious matter than it might appear on the surface to be. In situ, it was a thing of no concern. Gone, it becomes an affair of almost vital import. To issue orders impossible of fulfillment, as Helmuth did when he said, "Comb Trenko inch by inch," is easy. To comb this galaxy star by star for Medon would be an even more difficult and longer task. But what can be done is being done. To return to the conclusions, they point out a state of things which I do not have to tell you is really grave. This is the first major setback which the culture of the Boscone has encountered since it began its rise. You are familiar with that rise, how we of the Ike took over in a city, a race, a planet, a solar system, a region, a galaxy. How we extended our sway into the Tellurian galaxy as a preliminary to the extension of our authority throughout all the populated galaxies of the macrocosmic universe. You know our creed. To the victor, the power. He who is strongest and fittest shall survive and shall rule. This so-called civilization which is opposing us, which began upon Tellus but whose driving force is that which dwells upon Aresia, is a soft, weak, puny-spirited thing indeed to resist the mental and material power of our culture. Myriads of beings upon each planet, each one striving for power and, so striving, giving of that power to him above. Myriads of planets each, in return for our benevolently despotic control, delegating and contributing power to the Ike. All this power, delegated to the thousands of millions of the Ike of this planet, culminates in and is wielded by the nine of us who compose Boscone. Power! Our forefathers thought that control of one planet was enough. Later it was declared that mastery of a galaxy, if realized, would sate ambition. We of Boscone, however, now know that our power shall be limited only by the bounds of the material cosmic all. Every world that exists throughout space shall and must pay homage and tribute to Boscone. What, gentlemen, is the sense of this meeting? Aresia must be visited!
There was no need of integrating this thought. It was dominant and unanimous.
I would advise caution, however.
The eighth of Boscone amended his ballot.
We are an old race, it is true, and able. I cannot help but believe, however, that in Aresia there exists an unknown quality, an X,
effects, which we are as yet unable to evaluate. It must be borne in mind that Helmuth, while not of the Ike, was nevertheless an able being. Yet he was handled so mercilessly there that he could not render a complete or conclusive report of his expedition then or ever. With these thoughts in mind, I suggest that no actual landing be made, but that the torpedo be launched from a distance. The suggestion is eminently sound, the first approved. As to Helmuth, he was, for an oxygen breather, fairly able. He was, however, mentally soft, as are all such. Do you, our foremost psychologist, believe that any existent or conceivable mind, even that of a Plurin, could break yours with no application of physical force or device, as Helmuth's report seemed to indicate that his was broken? I use the word seemed advisedly, for I do not believe that Helmuth reported the actual truth. In fact, I was about to replace him with an Ike, however unpleasant such an assignment would be to any of our race because of that weakness. No, agreed the Eighth. I do not believe that there exists in the universe a mind of sufficient power to break mine. It is a truism that no mental influence, however powerful, can affect a strong, definitely and positively opposed will. For that reason, I voted against the use of thought screens by our agents. Such screens expose them to detection and can be of no real benefit. Physical means must have been used first, and after physical subjugation, the screens were, of course, useless. I am not sure that I agree with you entirely, the Ninth put in. We have here cogent evidence that there have been employed mental forces of a type or pattern with which we are entirely unfamiliar. While it is the consensus of opinion that the importance of Helmuth's report should be minimized, it seems to me that we have enough corroborative evidence to indicate that this mentality may be able to operate without material aid. If so, rigid screening should be retained as offering the only possible safeguard from such force. Sound in theory, but in practice dubious, the psychologist countered. If there were any evidence whatever that the screens had done any good, I would agree with you, but have they? Screening failed to save Helmuth, or his base. And there is nothing to indicate that the screens impeded even momentarily the progress of the supposititious lensman upon Radelix. You speak of rigid screening. The term is meaningless. Perfectly effective screening is impossible. If, as we seem to be doing, we postulate that the ability of one mind to control another without physical bodily contact can exist, nor is the idea at all far-fetched, considering what I myself have done to the minds of many of our agents. Then the lensman can work through any unshielded mentality whatever to attain his ends. As you know, Helmuth deduced, too late, that it must have been through the mind of a dog that the lensman invaded Grand Base.
Poppycock, snorted the Seventh. Or if not, we can kill the dogs or screen their minds too, he sneered.
Admitted, the psychologist returned, unmoved. You might conceivably kill all the animals that run and all the birds that fly. You cannot, however, destroy all life in all locality at all extended clear down to the worms and their burrows and the termites and their hidden retreats. And the mind does not exist which can draw a line of demarcation and say, here begins intelligent life.
This discussion is interesting but futile, put in Eichlin, forestalling a scornful reply. It is more to the point, I think, to discuss that which must be done, or rather, who is to do it, since the thing itself admits of only one solution, an atomic bomb of sufficient power to destroy every trace of life upon that accursed planet.
Shall we send someone, or shall some of us ourselves go? To overestimate a foe is at worst only an unnecessary precaution. To underestimate this one may well prove fatal. Therefore, it seems to me that the decision in this matter should lie with our psychologist. I will, however, if you prefer, integrate our various conclusions.
Recourse to the machine was unnecessary. It was agreed by all that Eichamp, the 8th of Boscone, should decide.
"My decision will be evident," that worthy said, measuredly, "when I say that I myself, for one, am going. The situation is admittedly a serious one. Moreover, I believe, to a greater extent than do the rest of you, that there is a certain amount of truth in Helmuth's version of his experiences. My mind is the only one in existence of whose power I am absolutely certain, the only one which I definitely know will not give way before any conceivable mental force, whatever its amount or whatever its method of application. I want none with me save of the Ike, and even those I will examine carefully before permitting them aboard ship with me."
"You decide as I thought," said the first. "I also shall go. My mind will hold, I think."
"It will hold. In your case, examination is unnecessary," agreed the psychologist.
"And I!"
"And I!"
arose what amounted to a chorus.
"No,"
came curt denial from the first.
"Two are enough to operate all machinery and weapons. To take any more of the Boscone would weaken us here injudiciously. Well, you know how many are working, and in what fashions for seats at this table. To take any weaker mind, even of the Ike, might conceivably be to court disaster. We too should be safe. I believe I have proven repeatedly my right to hold the title of first of this council, the rulers and masters of the dominant race of the universe. Eichamp, because of his unparalleled knowledge of all intelligence. Our vessel is ready. We go."
As has been indicated, none of the Ike were, or ever had been, cowards. Tyrants they were, it is true, and dictators of the harshest, sternest, and most soulless kind. Callous and merciless they were, cold as the rocks of their frigid world and as utterly ruthless and remorseless as the fabled Juggernaut, but they were as logical as they were hard. He who, of them all, was best fitted to do anything, did it unquestioningly, and as a matter of course, did it with the calmly emotionless efficiency of the machine, which in actual fact he was. Therefore, it was the first, and the 8th, of Boscone, who went. Through the star-studded purlieus of the second galaxy, the black, airless, lightless vessel sped. Through the reaches vaster and more tenuous far of intergalactic space, into the Tellurian galaxy, up to a solar system shunned then, as now, by all uninvited intelligences, dread and dreaded, Aresia. Not close to the planet did even the two of Boscone venture, but stopped at the greatest distance at which a torpedo could be directed surely against the target. But even so, the vessel of the Ike had punctured a screen of mental force, and as Eichlin extended a tentacle toward the firing mechanism of his missiles, watched in as much suspense as they were capable of feeling by the planet-bound 7 of Boscone, a thought as penetrant as a needle and yet as binding as a cable of tempered steel drove into his brain.
"Hold!"
that thought commanded, and Eichlin held, as did also his fellow Bosconian. Both remained rigid, unable to move any single voluntary muscle, while the other 7 of the council looked on in uncomprehending amazement. Their instruments remained dead, since those mechanisms were not sensitive to thought. To them nothing at all was occurring. Those 7 leaders of the Ike, knew that something was happening, something dreadful, something untoward, something very decidedly not upon the program they had helped to plan. They, however, could do nothing about it. They could only watch and wait.
Ah, 'tis Lan and Amp of the Ike, thought resounded within the minds of the helpless twain.
Truly, the elders are correct. My mind is not yet competent, for although I have had many facts instead of but a single one upon which to cogitate, and no dearth of time in which to do so, I now perceive that I have erred grievously in my visualization of the cosmic all. You do, however, fit nicely into the now enlarged scheme, and I am really grateful to you for furnishing new material with which for many cycles of time to come I shall continue to build. Indeed, I believe that I shall permit you to return unharmed to your own planet. You know the warning we gave Helmuth, your minion. Hence your lives are forfeit for violating knowingly the privacy of Aresia. But wanton or unnecessary destruction is not conducive to mental growth. Therefore, you are at liberty to depart. I repeat to you the instructions given your underling. Do not return, either in person or by any form whatever of proxy. The Aresian had as yet exerted scarcely a fraction of his power. Although the bodies of the two invaders were practically paralyzed, their minds had not been punished. Therefore, the psychologist said coldly,
"You are not now dealing with Helmuth, nor with any other weak, mindless oxygen breather, but with the Ike."
And by sheer effort of will, he moved toward the controls.
"What boots it?"
The Aresian compressed upon the eighth's brain a searing force which sent shrieking waves of pain throughout all nearby space. Then, taking over the psychologist's mind, he forced him to move to the communicator panel, upon whose plate could be seen the other seven of Boscone, gazing in wonder.
"Set up planetary coverage,"
he directed through ICAMP's organs of speech,
"so that each individual member of the entire race of the Ike can understand what I am about to transmit."
There was a brief pause. Then the deep, measured voice rolled on.
"I am Eukonidor of Aresia, speaking to you through this mass of undead flesh, which was once your chief psychologist, ICAMP, the eighth of that High Council which you call Boscone. I had intended to spare the lives of these two simple creatures, but I perceive that such action would be useless. Their minds, and the minds of all of you who listen to me, are warped, perverted, incapable of reason. They and you would have misinterpreted the gesture completely, would have believed that I did not slay them only because I could not do so. Some of you would have offended again and again until you were so slain. You can be convinced of such a fact only by an unmistakable demonstration of superior force. Force is the only thing you are able to understand. Your one aim in life is to gain material power. Greed, corruption, and crime are your chosen implements. You consider yourselves hard and merciless. In a sense, and according to your abilities, you are, although your minds are too callow to realize that there are depths of cruelty and of depravity which you cannot even faintly envision. You love and worship power.
Why?
To any thinking mind it should be clear that such a lust intrinsically is, and forever must be, by its very nature, futile. For even if any one of you could command the entire material universe, what good would it do him? None. What would he have? Nothing.
Not even the satisfaction of accomplishment for that lust is in fact insatiable. It would then turn upon itself and feed upon itself. I tell you as a fact that there is only one power which is at one and the same time illimitable and yet finite, insatiable yet satisfying, one which, while eternal, yet invariably returns to its possessor the true satisfaction of real accomplishment in exact ratio to the effort expended upon it. That power is the power of the mind. You, being so backward and so wrong of development, cannot understand how this fact can be. But if any one of you will concentrate upon one single fact or small object, such as a pebble, or the seed of a plant, or other creature, for as short a period of time as 100 of your years, you will begin to perceive its truth. You boast that your planet is old. What of that? We of Aresia dwelt in turn upon many planets, from planetary youth to cosmic old age, before we became independent of the transformation of such celestial bodies. You prate that you are an ancient race. Compared to us, you are sheerly infantile. We of Aresia did not originate upon a planet formed during the recent interpassage of these two galaxies, but upon one which came into being in an antiquity so distant that the figure in years would be entirely meaningless to your minds. We were of an age, to your mentalities, starkly incomprehensible when your most remote ancestors began to wriggle about in the slime of your parent world. Do the men of the patrol know? I perceive the question in your minds. They do not. None, save a few of the most powerful of their minds, has the slightest inkling of the truth. To reveal any portion of it to civilization as a whole would blight that civilization irreparably. Though seekers after truth in the best sense, they are essentially juvenile, and their lifespans are ephemeral indeed. The mere realization that there is in existence such a race as ours would place upon them such an inferiority complex as would make further advancement impossible. In your case, such a course of events is not to be expected. You will close your minds to all that has happened, declaring to yourselves that it was impossible and that therefore it could not have taken place and did not. Nevertheless, you will stay away from Aresia henceforth. But, to resume, you consider yourselves long-lived. Know then, insects, that your lifespan of 1,000 of your years is but a moment. I, myself, have already lived many such periods, and I am but a youth, a mere watchman, not yet to be entrusted with really serious thinking. I have spoken over long, the reason for my prolixity being that I do not like to see the energy of a race so misused, so corrupted to material conquest for its own sake. I would like to set your minds upon the way of truth, if perchance such a thing would be possible. I have pointed out that way. Whether or not you follow it is for you to decide. Indeed, I fear that most of you, in your short-sighted pride, have already cast my message aside, refusing point-blank to change your habits of thought. It is, however, in the hope that some few of you will perceive the way and will follow it, that I have discoursed at such length. Whether or not you change your habits of thought, I advise you to heed this, my warning. Aresia does not want, and will not, tolerate intrusion. As a lesson, watch these two violators of our privacy destroy themselves. The giant voice ceased. Eichlin's tentacles moved toward the controls. The vast torpedo launched itself. But instead of hurtling toward distant Aresia, it swept around in a circle and struck in direct central impact the great cruiser of the Ike. There was an appalling crash, a space-racking detonation, a flare of incandescence, incredible and indescribable as the energy calculated to disrupt, almost to volatilize, a world expended itself upon the insignificant mass of one Bosconian battleship, and upon the unresisting texture of the void. Chapter 10. The Negasphere. Considerably more than the stipulated week passed before Kinnison was done with the librarian and with the long-range communicator beam, but eventually he succeeded in enlisting the aid of the 53 most eminent scientists and thinkers of all the planets of galactic civilization. From all over the galaxy were they selected, from Vandemar and Centralia and Alcicon, from Chicladoria and Radalix, from the solar systems of Rigel and Sirius and Antares. Millions of planets were not represented at all, and of the few which were, Tellus alone had more than one delegate. This was necessary, Kinnison explained carefully to each of those chosen. Sir Austin Cardynge, the man whose phenomenal brain had developed a new mathematics to handle the positron and the negative energy levels, was the one who could do the work. He himself was present merely as coordinator and observer. The meeting place, even, was not upon Tellus, but upon Medon, the newly acquired and hence entirely neutral planet, for the gray lensman knew well the minds with which he would have to deal. They were all geniuses of the highest rank, but in all too many cases their stupendous mentalities verged altogether too closely upon insanity for any degree of comfort. Even before the conclave assembled, it became evident that jealousy was to be rife and rampant. And after the initial meeting at which the problem itself was propounded, it required all of Kinnison's ability, authority, and drive, and all of Worsell's vast diplomacy and tact, to keep those mighty brains at work. Time after time, some essential entity, his dignity outraged, his touchy ego infuriated by some real or fancied insult, stalked off in high dudgeon to return to his own planet, only to be coaxed and bullied, or even mentally manhandled by Kinnison or Worsell, or both, into returning to his task. Nor were those insults all, or even mostly, imaginary. Quarreling and bickering were incessant, violent flare-ups, and passionate scenes of denunciation and vituperation were of almost hourly occurrence. Each of those minds had been accustomed to worldwide adulation, to the unquestioned acceptance as gospel of his every idea or pronouncement, and to have to submit his work to the scrutiny and to the unworshipful criticism of lesser minds, actually to have to give way at times to those inferior mentalities. Well, that was a situation quite definitely intolerable. But at length, most of them began to work together, as they appreciated the fact that the problem before them was one which none of them singly had been able even partially to solve. And Kinnison let the others, the most fanatically non-cooperative, go home. Then progress began, and none too soon. The gray lensman had lost 25 pounds in weight, and even the iron-thewed Worsell was a wreck. He could not fly, he declared, because his wings buckled in the middle. He could not crawl, because his belly plates clashed against his backbone. And finally, the thing was done, reduced to a set of equations which could be written upon a single sheet of paper. It is true that those equations would have been meaningless to almost anyone then alive, since they were based upon a system of mathematics which had been brought into existence at that very meeting. But Kinnison had taken care of that. No Medonian had been allowed in the conference. The admittance of one to membership would have caused a massed exodus of the high-strung, temperamental maniacs working so furiously there. But the Tellurian lensman had recorded every act, almost every thought, of every one of those geniuses. Those records had been studied for weeks, not only by Wise of Medon and his staff, but also by a corps of the less brilliant, but infinitely better balanced scientists of the patrol proper. "Now you fellows can really get to work," Kinnison heaved a sigh of profound relief as the last member of the conference figuratively shook the dust of Medon off his robe as he departed homeward.
"I'm going to sleep for a week. Call me, will you, when you get the model done?"
This was the sheerest exaggeration, of course, for nothing could have kept the lensman from watching the construction of that first apparatus. He watched the erection of a spherical shell of loosely latticed trusswork, some 20 feet in diameter. He watched the installation, at its 6 cardinal points, of atomic exciters, each capable of transforming 10,000 pounds per hour of substance into pure energy. He knew that those exciters were driving their intake screens at a ratio of at least 20,000 to 1. That energy equivalent to the annihilation of at least 600,000 tons per hour of material was being hurled into the center of that web from the 6 small mechanisms, which were, in fact, super Bergenholms. Nor is that word adequate to describe them. Their fabrication would have been utterly impossible without Medonian conductors and insulation. He watched the construction of a conveyor and a chute, and looked on intently while 100,000 tons of refuse, rocks, sand, concrete, scrap iron, loose metal, debris of all kinds, were dropped into that innocuous-appearing sphere, only to vanish as though they had never existed.
"But we ought to be able to see it by this time, I should think," Kinnison protested once.
"Not yet, Kim," Master Technician Laverne Thorndike informed him. "Just forming the vortex, microscopic yet. I haven't the faintest idea of what is going on in there. But man, dear man, am I glad I'm here to help make it go on."
"But when?" demanded the lensman. "How soon will you know whether it's going to work or not? I've got to do a flit."
"You can flit any time, now if you like," the technician told him brutally. "We don't need you anymore. You've done your bit. It's working now. If it wasn't, do you think we could pack all that stuff into that little space?"
"We'll have it done long before you'll need it."
"But I want to see it work, you big lug," Kinnison retorted, only half playfully. "Come back in 3 or 4 days, maybe a week, but don't expect to see anything but a hole."
"That's exactly what I want to see, a hole in space."
And that was precisely what, a few days later, the lensman did see. The spherical framework was unchanged. The machines were still carrying easily their incredible working load. Material, any and all kinds of stuff, was still disappearing instantaneously, invisibly, quietly, with no flash or fury to mark its passing. But at the center of that massive sphere there now hung poised a
something. Or was it a nothing?
Mathematically, it was a sphere, or rather a negasphere, about the size of a baseball. But the eye, while it could see something, could not perceive it analytically. Nor could the mind envision it in 3 dimensions, for it was not essentially 3-dimensional in nature. Light sank into the thing, whatever it was, and vanished. The peering eye could see nothing whatever of shape or of texture. The mind behind the eye reeled away before infinite vistas of nothingness. Kinnison hurled his extrasensory perception into it and jerked back, almost stunned. It was neither darkness nor blackness, he decided, after he recovered enough poise to think coherently. It was worse than that. Worse than anything imaginable, an infinitely vast and yet non-existent realm of the total absence of everything whatever. Absolute negation.
"That's it, I guess," the lensman said then. "Might as well stop feeding it now."
"We would have to stop soon in any case," Wise replied, "for our available waste material is becoming scarce. It will take the substance of a fairly large planet to produce that which you require. You have perhaps a planet in mind which is to be used for that purpose?"
"Better than that. I have in mind the material of just such a planet, but already broken up into sizes convenient for handling."
"Oh! The asteroid belt!" Thorndike exclaimed. "Fine! Kill 2 birds with 1 stone, huh? Build this thing and at the same time clear out the menaces to inert interplanetary navigation? But how about the miners?"
"All covered. The ones actually in development will be let alone. They're not menaces anyway, as they all have broadcasters. The tramp miners we send, at patrol expense and grubstake,
to some other system to do their mining. But there's one more point before we flit. Are you sure you can ship to the second stage without an accident?
Positive. Build another one around it, mount new bergs, exciters, and screens on it, and let this one, machines and all, go in to feed the kitty, whatever it is.
QX. Let's go, fellows. Two huge Tellurian freighters were at hand, and, holding the small framework between them in a net of tractors and pressers, they set off blithely toward Sol. They took a couple of hours for the journey. There was no hurry, and in the handling of this particular freight, caution was decidedly of the essence. Arrived at destination, the crews tackled with zest and zeal this new game. Tractors lashed out, seizing chunks of iron.
"Pick out the little ones, men," cautioned Kinnison. "Nothing over about 10 feet in section dimension will go into this frame. Better wait for the second frame before you try to handle the big ones."
"We can cut 'em up," Thorndike suggested. "What have we got these shear planes for?"
"QX if you like, just so you keep the kitty fed."
"We'll feed her."
And the game went on. Chunks of debris, some rock, but mostly solid meteoric nickel iron, shot toward the vessels and the ravening sphere, becoming inertialess as they entered a wide-flung zone. Pressers seized them avidly, pushing them through the interstices of the framework, holding them against the voracious screen. As they touched the screen, they disappeared. No matter how fast they were driven, the screen ate them away, silently and unspectacularly, as fast as they could be thrown against it. A weird spectacle indeed, to see a jagged fragment of solid iron, having a mass of thousands of tons, drive against that screen and disappear. For it vanished, utterly, along a geometrically perfect spherical surface. From the opposite side, the eye could see the mirror sheen of the metal at the surface of disintegration. It was as though the material was being shoved out of our familiar three-dimensional space into another universe, which, as a matter of cold fact, may have been the case. For not even the men who were doing the work made any pretense of understanding what was happening to that iron. Indeed, the only entities who did have any comprehension of the phenomenon, the 40-odd geniuses whose mathematical wizardry had made it possible, thought of it and discussed it, not in the limited three-dimensional symbols of everyday existence, but only in the language of high mathematics, a language in which few indeed are able really to readily think. And while the crews became more and more expert at the new technique, so that metal came in faster and faster, huge, hot-sliced bars of iron 10 feet square and a quarter of a mile long were being driven into that enigmatic sphere of extinction, an outer framework 150 miles in diameter was being built. Nor, contrary to what might be supposed, was a prohibitive amount of metal or of labor necessary to fabricate that mammoth structure. Instead of 6, there were 6 cubed, 216, working stations, complete with generators and super Bergenholms and screen generators, each mounted upon a massive platform. But instead of being connected and supported by stupendous beams and trusses of metal, those platforms were linked by infinitely stronger bonds of pure force. It took a lot of ships to do the job. But the technicians of the patrol had at call enough floating machine shops and to spare. When the sphere of negation grew to be about a foot in apparent diameter, it had been found necessary to surround it with a screen opaque to all visible light, for to look into it long or steadily then meant insanity. Now the opaque screen was 16 feet in diameter, nearing dangerously the sustaining framework, and the outer frame was ready. It was time to change. The lensman held his breath. But the Madonians and the Tellurian technicians did not turn a hair as they mounted their new stations and tested their apparatus. Ready.
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 Station after station reported. Then, as Thorndike threw in the master switch, the primary sphere, invisible now through distance to the eye but plain upon the visiplates, disappeared. A mere morsel to those new gigantic forces.
"Swing into it, boys!" Thorndike yelled into his transmitter. "We don't have to feed her with a teaspoon anymore. Let her have it!"
And let her have it they did. No more cutting up of the larger meteorites. Asteroids 10, 15, 20 miles in diameter, along with hosts of smaller stuff, were literally hurled through the black screen into the even lusher blackness of that which was inside it, without complaint from the quietly humming motors. "Satisfied, Kim?" Thorndyke asked.
"Uh-huh,"
the lensman assented vigorously.
"Nice. Slick, in fact," he commended. "I'll buzz off now, I guess."
"Might as well. Everything's on the green. Clear ether, spacehound."
"Same to you, big fella. I'll be seeing you or sending you a thought. There's Tellus, right over there."
"Funny, isn't it? Doing a flit to a place you can actually see before you start."
The trip to Earth was scarcely a hop, even in a supply boat. To Prime Base the gray lensman went, where he found that his new non-ferrous speedster was done, and during the next few days he tested it out thoroughly. It did not register at all, neither upon the regular long-range ultra instruments, nor upon the short-range emergency electros. Nor could it be seen in space, even in a telescope at point-blank range. True, it occulted an occasional star, but since even the direct rays of a searchlight failed to reveal its shape to the keenest eye, the lensman chemists who had worked out that 99.99% absolute black coating had done a wonderful job. The chance of discovery through that occurrence was very slight.
"QX, Kim?" the port admiral asked. He was accompanying the gray lensman on a last tour of inspection.
"Fine, chief. Couldn't be better. Thanks a lot."
"Sure you're non-ferrous yourself?"
"Absolutely. Not even an iron nail in my shoes."
"What is it, then? You look worried. Want something expensive?"
"You hit the thumb, Admiral, right on the nail. But it's not only expensive. We may never have any use for it."
"Better build it anyway. Then, if we want it, you'll have it. And if you don't want it, we can always use it for something. What is it?"
"It's a nutcracker. There are a lot of cold planets around, aren't there, that aren't good for anything?"
"Thousands of them. Millions.
The Madonians put Bergenholms on their planet and flew it from Lundmark's nebula to here in a few weeks. Why wouldn't it be a sound idea to have the planetographers pick out a couple of useless worlds which, at some points in their orbits, have diametrically opposite velocities to within a degree or two?"
"You've got something there, my boy. Will do. Very much worth having, just for its own sake, even if we never have any use for it. Anything else?"
"Not a thing in the universe. Clear ether, chief."
"Light landings, Kinnison." And gracefully, effortlessly, the dead black sliver of semi-precious metal lifted herself away from Earth.
Through Bominger, the Raelian Big Shot, Kinnison had had a long and eminently satisfactory interview with Prellin, the regional director of all surviving Bosconian activities. Thus, he knew where he was, even to the street address, and knew the name of the firm which was his alias, Ethan D. Wimbleson and Sons, Incorporated, 4627 Boulevard des Ailes, Kamenoki, Quadrant 8, Brunsica. That name had been his first shock, for that firm was one of the largest and most conservative houses in galactic trade, one having an unquestioned AA-A1 rating in every mercantile index. However, that was the way they worked, Kinnison reflected, as his speedster reeled off the parsecs. It wasn't far to Bronsica, easy lens distance. He'd better call somebody there and start making arrangements.
He had heard about the planet, although he'd never been there.
Somewhat warmer than Tellus, but otherwise very Earth-like, millions of Tellurians lived there and liked it. His approach to the planet, Bronsica, was characterized by all possible caution, as was his visit to Kamenoki, the capital city. He found that 4627 Boulevard des Ailes was a structure covering an entire city block and some 80 stories high, owned and occupied exclusively by Wimblesons. No visitors were allowed except by appointment. His first stroll past it showed him that an immense cylinder, comprising almost the whole interior of the building, was shielded by thought screens. He rode up and down in the elevators of nearby buildings, no penetration. He visited a dozen offices in the neighborhood upon various errands, choosing his time with care so that he would have to wait in each an hour or so in order to see his man. These leisurely scrutinies of his objective failed to reveal a single fact of value. Ethan D. Wimbleson and Sons, Incorporated, did a tremendous business, but every ounce of it was legitimate. That is,
The files in the outer offices covered only legitimate transactions, and the men and women busily at work there were all legitimately employed. And the inner offices, vastly more extensive than the outer, to judge by the number of employees entering in the morning and leaving at the close of business, were sealed against his prying every second of every day. He tapped in turn the minds of dozens of those clerks, but drew only blanks. As far as they were concerned, there was nothing queer going on anywhere in the organization. The old man, Howard Wembleson, a grand-nephew or something of Ethan, had developed a complex lately that his life was in danger. Scarcely ever left the building, not that he ever had any need to, as he had always had palatial quarters there, and then only under heavy guard. A good many thought-screened persons came and went, but a careful study of them and their movements convinced the gray lensman that he was wasting his time. "No soap," he reported to a lensman at Bronsika's base. "Might as well try to stick a pin quietly into a cat eagle. He's been told that he's the next link in the chain. He's got the jitters right. I'll bet he's got a dozen loose observers instead of only one. I'll save time, I think, by tracing another line. I have thought before that my best bet is in the asteroid dens instead of on the planets. I let them talk me out of it. It's a dirty job, and I've got to establish an identity of my own, which will be even dirtier. But it looks as though I'll have to get back to it."
"But the others are warned, too," suggested the Bronsican. "They'll probably be just as bad. Let's just blast it open and take a chance on finding the data you want."
"No," Kinnison said emphatically. "Not a chance. That's not the way to get anything I'm looking for. The others are probably warned, yes. But since they aren't on my direct line of the throne, they probably aren't taking it as seriously as this Prellin, or Wembleson, is. Or if they are, they won't keep it up as long. They can't, and get any joy out of life at all." "And you can't say a word to Prellin about his screens, either," the Tellurian went on in reply to a thought. "They're legal enough, just as much so as spy ray blocks. Every man has a right to privacy. Just one question here, or just one suspicious move, is apt to blow everything into a cocked hat. You fellows keep on working along the lines we laid out, and I'll try another line. If it works, I'll come back and we'll open this can the way you want to. That way, we may be able to get the lowdown on about 400 planetary organizations at one haul." Thus it came about that Kinnison took his scarcely used indetectable speedster back to Prime Base, and that, in a solar system prodigiously far removed from both Tellus and Bronsika, there appeared another tramp meteor miner. Peculiar people, these toilers in the interplanetary voids, flotsam and jetsam, for the most part the very scum of space. Some solar systems contain more asteroidal and meteoric debris than did ours of Sol, others less, but few, if any, have none at all. In the main, this material is either nickel iron or rock, but some of these fragments carry prodigious values in platinum, osmium, and other noble metals, and occasionally there are discovered diamonds and other gems of tremendous size and value. Hence, in the asteroid belts of every solar system there are to be found those universally despised but nevertheless bold and hardy souls who, risking life and limb from moment to moment though they are, yet live in hope that the next lump of cosmic detritus will prove to be bonanza. Some of these men are the sheer misfits of life. Some are petty criminals, fugitives from the justice of their own planets, but not of sufficient importance to be upon the wanted lists of the patrol. Some are of those who, for some reason or other, addiction to drugs perhaps, or the overwhelming urge occasionally to go on a spree, are unable or unwilling to hold down the steady jobs of their more orthodox brethren. Still others, and these are many, live that horridly adventurous life because it is in their blood. Like the lumberjacks who in ancient times dwelt upon Tellus, they labor tremendously and unremittingly for weeks only and deliberately to blow in the fruits of their toil in a few wild days, and still wilder nights of hectic, sanguine, and lustful debauchery in one or another of the spaceman's hells of which every inhabited solar system has its quota. But whatever their class, they have much in common. They all live for the moment only, from hand to mouth. They are all intrepid spacemen. They have to be. No others last long. They all live hardly, dangerously,
and violently. They are men of red and gusty passions, and they have, if not an actual contempt, at least a loud-voiced scorn of the law in its every phase and manifestation. Law ends with atmosphere, is the galaxy-wide creed of the clan, and it is a fact that no law save that of the ray gun is even yet really in force in the Badlands of the asteroid belts. Indeed, the meteor miners, as a matter of course, take their innate lawlessness with them into their revels in the crimson-lit resorts already referred to. In general, the nearby planetary police adopt a laissez-faire attitude, particularly since the asteroids are not within their jurisdictions, but are independent worlds, each with its own world government. If they kill a dozen or so of each other and of the bloodsuckers who batten upon them, what of it? If everybody in those hells could be killed at once, the universe would be that much better off. And if the Galactic Patrol is compelled, by some unusually outrageous performance, to intervene in the revelry, it comes in not as single policemen, but in platoons or in companies of armed, full-armored infantry going to war. Such, then, were those among whom Kinnison chose to cast his lot, in a new effort to get in touch with the Galactic Director of the Drug Ring. Chapter 11. Hijackers. Although Kinnison left Bronsica, abandoning that line of attack completely, thereby, it might be thought, forfeiting all the work he had theretofore done upon it, the patrol was not idle. Nor was Prelin Wembleson of Kominoki, the Bosconian regional director, neglected. Lensman after lensman came and went unobtrusively but grimly determined. There came Tellurians, Venerians, Menarchans, Borovans, lensmen of every human breed, any of whom might have been, as far as the minions of Boscone knew, the one foe whom they had such good cause to fear. Rigellian lensmen came also, and Posenians, and Ordovics, representatives, in fact, of almost every available race possessing any type or kind of extrasensory perception, came to test out their skill and cunning. Even Warsel of Valantia came, hurled for days his mighty mind against those screens, and departed. Whether or not business went on as usual, no one could say. But the patrol was certain of three things. First, that while the Bosconians might be destroying some of their records, they were moving none away by air, land, or tunnel. Second, that there was no doubt in any Zwilnik mind that the Lensmen were there to stay until they won, in one way or another. And third, that Prelin's life was not a happy one. And while his brothers of the Lens were so efficiently pinch-hitting for him, even though they were at the same time trying to show him up and thereby win kudos for themselves, in mentally investing the regional stronghold of Boscone, Kinnison was establishing an identity as a wandering Hellion of the asteroid belts. There would be no slips this time. He would be a meteor miner in every particular, down to the last least detail. To this end, he selected his equipment with the most exacting care. It must be thoroughly adequate and dependable, but neither new nor of such outstanding quality or amount as to cause comment. His ship, a stubby, powerful space tug with an oversized airlock, was a used job. Hard used, too. Some 10 years old. She was battered, pitted, and scarred. But it should be noted here, perhaps parenthetically, that when the patrol technicians finished their rebuilding, she was actually as staunch as a battleship. His space armor, Spalding drills, delameters, tractors and pressors, and Speegee, torsion-specific gravity apparatus, were of the same grade. All bore unmistakable evidence of years of hard use, but all were in perfect working order. In short, his outfit was exactly that which a successful meteor miner, even such a one as he was going to become, would be expected to own. He cut his own hair and his whiskers, too, with ordinary shears, as was good technique. He learned the polyglot of the trade, the language which, made up of words of each of hundreds of planetary tongues, was and is the everyday speech of human or near-human meteor miners wherever found. By near-human is meant a six-place classification of AAA-AAA, meaning oxygen-breathing, warm-blooded, erect, and having more or less humanoid heads, arms, and legs.
for even in meteor mining, like runs with like. Warm-blooded oxygen breathers find neither welcome nor enjoyment in a pleasure resort operated by and for such a race, say, as the Trochanthers, who are cold-blooded, quasi-reptilian beings who abhor light of all kinds and who breathe a gaseous mixture not only paralyzingly cold but also chemically fatal to man. Above all, he had to learn how to drink strong liquors and how to take drugs, for he knew that no drink that had ever been distilled and no drug, with the possible exception of thionite, could enslave the mind he then had. Thionite was out anyway. It was too scarce and too expensive for meteor miners. They simply didn't go for it. Hadiv, heroin, opium, nitrolabe, bentlam, that was it, bentlam. He could get it anywhere, all over the galaxy, and it was very much in character. Easy to take, potent in results, and not as damaging, if you didn't become a real addict, to the system as most of the others. He would become a bentlam eater.